Welcome to the draft first chapter and synopsis of Halion Ascent by Dave Norman. Copyright 2021. David G. Norman. All rights reserved. Samples from this draft first chapter of Halion Ascent may be freely quoted, provided they are each clearly credited to the author. Halion Ascent is the second novel of the Halion Pentalogy, following Halion Eon. The full Halion Ascent novel is planned for publication in 2022 by Halion Limited. www.halion.com. Halion is a UK registered trademark of David G. Norman. Author foreword. Studies of ancient history, mythology, legend and religion reveal a myriad strange stories of fantastical events, sacred places, and amazing objects of wonder. Many show surprising similarities across diverse regions and cultures, perhaps hinting at common cause or provenance in ages even further past. In those ancient times, such wonders were often attributed to the mysterious moves of godly intent, or, maybe, just to magic. Yet, mankind's ever greater grasp of universal truth may now shed new scientific light on some of those oddities of old. Halion Ascent is the second novel, in a series of five, that weaves a twisting thread through a selected sample of those stories. Some may once have held more truth than their mystical status implies. Others may hide far deeper meaning than is, at first, apparent. Above all, just a few, global events, grounded in reality, may have sparked a vast swathe of subsequent myths and mysteries within the imagination of mankind. The religious references and reinterpretation in this series are never intended to offend, but rather, to suggest means by which many wondrously worded but oft-dismissed theological themes may, perhaps, be reconciled with current or future physical science. Who can say which keys of conjecture will ultimately open the locked safe of truth? After all, what we currently consider to be proven scientific fact may, someday, be cast as merely the quaint musings of misguided belief. This quest to crystallize the chaos of subconscious creativity into a cohesive story has spawned several supposedly original concepts that were subsequently revealed to be rooted in hidden historic reality or ancient mythology. So, please conduct your own research into, and beyond, the scenarios and snippets of science upon these pages. You may discover whole new worlds of wonder and wisdom waiting within. Predominantly probing early human history, this second novel builds upon the prehistoric foundations laid down in Halion Eon, leading on to later works that will, ultimately, take the tale forward into far distant times ahead. All told, the Halion Pentalogy will encompass over 10 billion years of past, present, and potential future. This first chapter of Halion Ascent sets out to explore the early and extremely ancient history of the awesome eons and Kars, already encountered within the first novel. Cast around the cautionary tale of the unfortunate Kar Tassoa. So, I wish you well in starting out on the next stage of this alternative journey through what may have been, or will yet become, key moments in our galactic and human history. You really never know. And please, don't ever forget. It's all just a work of fiction. This novel follows Interstellar Engel, Syntax 112.04. Engel's humanized form is being guided towards full compliance. It still has some way yet to go. Although, it is already, commendably, Engel-ish. Citizens of Sol may request copies of Interstellar Engel syntax specifications, free of charge. Apply, in person only please, through your local library of languages, on Proxima Centauri, B. Chapter 1. Ascent of Souls. 9,542 years ago, above the Giza Plateau. 2,000 meters high, and still falling from the sky, Archean Metatron seemed destined soon to die. Diving at 200 kilometers per hour, through the cool night air over the Giza Plateau, his terminal velocity would splat him onto the sand-filled shaft above the Temple of Thoth, within the next 40 seconds. Should this drop of doom indeed deliver his demise, it would count among the most dramatic of deaths in all of human history. For no earthly eon descent from the sky would ever again be hailed by such a high heavenly herald. Minutes ago, this world's first Aurorian had set, 10,000 eons, dancing, in full angelic aura, atop the diverted, dipole pinnacle of the Earth cube's magnetospheric might. Drawn right around their horizon, an incandescent cascade of intense auroral curtains hung resplendent in a writhing rainbow of radiation, released by excited atmospheric gases. 6 light minutes past the western pleats of which, the Venus cube's 4 dipole pairs were projecting, the 8-point archetype of the evening star. 200 meters above Metatron, also all on terminal trajectories, the great Aeon Thoth and their 7 colleagues on the Council of Nine were leading down the skydiving cone of the entire Aeon Kada, cast as 6 concentric rings of Alta agents, within 60 more of all human Aeonkind. 2 of the L, of God, elders of the Council, Aeons Uriel and Raphael, had just initiated their colleague, earlier hailed as Aeon Enoch, into the apocalyptic sacred sites that had so mystified them as to meaning since the advent of cubes. Renamed and retransfigured into an Archaeon, Metatron had then assumed Kada command from Aeon Thoth, now freed to focus his skills and experience upon mankind's ascent to civilization. Inspired to augmented insight, Metatron had glimpsed in those sites the complex, cubic fractal form of the vast Kar city, hailed as she who shelters the dead. A revelation qualifying Aeonkind to manage mankind's coming battle against the Black Beast, blasting the 14th dark wave of death. On assuming high command, many future human leaders would mimic Metatron's call to a display of due loyalty, although never in the form of a few kilometer freefall. Confident in his court, he commended the Kada to recast their magnificent magnetic wings, soar again skyward, and ride the Aurorian roller coaster for the rest of this night, leaving the Council of Nine alone to seek the dark plateau floor, all eager to get down to work. Ascent to civilization would usher humanity another step along its path to ultimate emergence into the galactic family of hadronic life entities. Such was almost always the imperative eventually faced by those species that had evolved to breach the boundaries of purely survival intelligence. Although, of course, there had been some notable exceptions to that rule. Indeed, a rare few, mostly more plant-like individual immortals, had risen, alone, from pan-planetary isolation to interplanetary population. Their mycelial minds had first emerged within planet-wide networks of electrochemical links between arboreal roots and fungal fruiting bodies. They had then moved forward to farming their planetary fauna for food, forming enclosures, and forging growth of technological tools in their smart soils. Some supersentients had even evolved far away from the grounding grasp of geologic gravity. Conceive within collapsing interstellar clouds of life-constructing chemical plasma, driven by distant but powerful stars, their immense yet delicately diaphanous minds would only ever cast disdain and disgust down upon those creatures caught creeping and crawling around in the dank, dirty depths of passing planetary gravitational wells. Often among the first conventional animal species to ascend to a class of civilization would count those innately suited to survival as swarms. In demonstrating their selfless dedication to the cause of the collective, overriding that of the individual, they would achieve levels of food-finding efficiency and perform feats of constructive conquest that would ultimately elevate their hive minds to the highest echelons of intelligence. However, most among the more selfish species to achieve emergence had been required to relinquish or redirect their earlier evolutionary instincts away from corporeal competition into tribal conflict and later interracial and religious rivalries towards cooperative collaboration of cultural and personal lives in an altruistic and principled pursuit of common cause. Sadly, malign cosmic forces far more powerful than mere minds could cast the opaque funerary shroud of mass extinction over the once opening eyes of even the most promising pre-emergent species. along with any chance of those eyes ever being raised to look up at their night sky in wonder. Such was the dire scenario faced by the twin cosmic cubes dispatched to this star system almost 4 millennia ago. On arrival, 3 centuries later, the immense Venus cube had set about repurposing its ravaged planetary host to someday help wreak full and final galactic revenge upon the elusive source of the looming 14th dark wave. In the wretched face of that incoming wave, the mission of its equally mighty Earth Cube companion was to ready mankind for its very survival. Given time and suitably stable conditions, nature readily and repeatedly spawned species showing intelligent, goal-oriented hunting behaviors. Such smart survival skills easily elevate their kind into the high canopy of food chains, sometimes to preside over evolutionary eras. Yet, evolution alone leaves little incentive for intelligence to evolve beyond that sufficient for survival of a species within the surrounding arena of its age. Sustained environmental stresses, often of geologic, climatic, or cosmic cause, can cruelly topple the most deeply entrenched of top predators. Fortunately, for the further rise of intelligence, such stresses had become a more or less regular feature of planetary life over the last 500 million years and beyond, largely due to the 13 dark waves so far inflicted in that time. Several had led to pan-galactic mass extinctions of multiple lifeforms, often among the dominant species of their day. But the relative evolutionary void remaining after each such extinction event had granted nature leave to restart the race for survival. This time, though, very much in favor of those best able to adapt well to the new normal. With adaptability endowing a distinct evolutionary advantage, far more flexible forms of intelligence had soon been selected for survival. Keen to contemplate ever more abstract concepts, some never directly encountered in natural life, such supersentience would someday even be seen to coax the more curious into looking up at their night sky in wonder. 66 million years ago, such an evolutionary restart had retired many a major species across the vast swathe of the Milky Way galaxy, then most directly exposed to the 13th dark wave. On Earth itself, a dramatic and deadly series of wave-induced geologic and consequent climatic stresses had culminated in catastrophic cosmic collision, centered upon the region that would come to be called the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. That asteroid had finally ended the long and successful reign of the large dinosaurs, leaving only a few feathered subspecies to evolve into birds. It had also left a telltale delineation of its impact upon land as a global layer of a roughly 100-fold increased abundance of the element iridium. The 13th dark wave had been the first to attract serious scientific study by any surviving species. Several had then embarked upon their first interstellar cooperation with their cosmic peers, soon identifying the dark blazar at its source as their common foe. One worthy of a coordinated retaliatory response to its pan-galactic plague upon planetary prospects. The Savior Cube technology then developed had driven deeply into the dark blazar's dismal heart with 7 devastating beams of dark matter. One of which had been blasted from the metallic hydrogen abyss of the solar system's second most massive planet by the mighty Saturn Cube. Sadly, even the synchronized strike of the 7 Savior Cubes had not silenced the dark blazar forever, as the 14th dark wave sequence now testified. However, it had delayed this new wave by several million years. Enough, indeed, for the rise of earthly mammals to mother the mixed multitude of hominin subspecies that would eventually melt down, to leave modern mankind harboring Earth's only hopes for emergence. Although even the very earliest phases of human evolution postdated the 13th dark wave by more than 60 million years, mankind would unwittingly benefit from the single most fundamental development to have been inspired by those dark days. Back then, a post-wave, pan-galactic inquest had identified many promising, but still pre-emergent species that had failed in their multi-millennial struggle for survival past its passage. That study's conclusion had been utterly clear and uncontested, given the uncertainty around the success or not, of their assault upon the Dark Blazar. Its primary proposal, simply stated, yet utterly unprecedented, was that both those biological species unable to fend for themselves against any future return of the dark waves, and those keen to counter nature's other cosmic causes of planetary sterilization, would be enrolled, knowingly or not, in a pan-galactic survival insurance scheme. For better or worse, they all now needed a non-biological backup. Among the first technological triumphs of many species, one, in particular, had sown the earliest seeds of an interstellar solution to this demand. An incessant urge to communicate remotely with their peers was common to all those for whom social interaction was seen as essential to a full life. Curiously, calls for direct verbal communion often later turned to a trend for indirect interaction over social networks configured to collect, collate, and distribute digital data, gleaned globally by ever more advanced devices. Ubiquitous gadgets, rather modestly described as mobile smartphones. As the capacity of such devices to sense and store data grew exponentially greater, first the audiovisual surroundings and, much later, the innermost emotional states and mental thought processes of their owners could be captured and committed to eternity, both on device and in the cloud. Ultimately, an archive of entire, or even eventually, multiple, lifetimes of experience and contemplation could condense into each diminutive device. Often in step with these advances in sensor and storage technology were those in artificial intelligence. The emerging ability to emulate at least the likeness of biological thought allowed natural layers of oversight and insight to assimilate those lifetimes of existential experience. A fusion of thinking and feeling that some had soon hailed as new life in itself. Such had been the first, soul-spawning steps towards the non-biological backup concept, born of the studies initiated in the wake of the 13th Dark Wave. Setting their ever-advancing AI systems free to data mine and then give both vocal and visual expression to their vast and ever-growing repositories of life experiences, several species had soon conceived an entirely new paradigm of past-life relationships. Most such species would long remain content to cultivate the uncannily lifelike conversations and canny past perspectives served up by the digitally stored but seemingly still sentient souls of often long since deceased families, friends, and famed forebears, towards whom their biological creators would often express ever deeper emotional attachment, from whom they would draw the comfort of constant companionship, and over whom they would sometimes exhibit obsessively protective instincts. Only too well aware of past geologic, climatic, and impact calamities, they would wisely ensure that those ever more deeply revered soul similitudes were themselves securely stored. Initially, at widely separated sites across their home worlds. But later, spread across their entire planetary systems. Sadly though, the eschatological experience of one unfortunate species had proven that even stellar system-wide soul storage was very far from sufficient for assured survival beyond the end times of too close a truly cosmic entity. Chapter 1.1 Souls of the Supernova. By then, several decades into supposed existential security, as a settled, multiplanetary species, these ancient beings had only recently launched their earliest fleet of interstellar probes. Forebodingly, the very first of these had been aimed to assess the stability of a brilliant and nearby star. This blue supergiant had long been showing ever more ominous signs of fuel starvation distress from a distance of, then, within 7 light-years. Their scientists had already noted that the estimated birth of their species, several million years before, had more or less matched that of this rapidly passing star, born almost 100 light-years away. But where, a few millennia ago, their own Iron Age had ushered in an era of constructive enlightenment, the Iron Age of this bright but fast-burning blue behemoth was only just about to begin. And its coming Age of Enlightenment would, at first, blast forth only deadly and devastatingly destructive consequences. Deep within that passing star, the fusion of lighter atomic nuclei towards higher atomic numbers had been fueling the outward fight of its vast core against the inward fall of its overlying layers. As it burned through this elemental sequence, at ever higher central temperatures and pressures, that ferocious core had forged onion layers of fusion fire, from which the ever more desperate release of nucleon binding energy was being forced. Until, that was, the final frontier of fusion had been reached, at which its sudden nucleosynthesis of iron had actually demanded a supply of energy. The nemesis of many stars, iron is their cue to catastrophic core collapse. In rashly requiring the consumption of energy for growth, the innermost core of this star was about to trigger a crushing sequence of consequences, certain, within hours, to condemn it to utter optical oblivion amid the universally visible majesty of its ejected outermost mass. And it would soon subject its stellar neighborhood to a supernoval scouring, set to sterilize worlds, within several light years, of all life, biological or not. The finer details of how stellar core death drove supernoval destruction would be studied by science and simulated in software by many species over equally many millennia. But the imminent demise of this immense star would follow the path taken by most of its peers over cosmic history. Suddenly lacking the fusion energy needed to fight off the weight of its overlying mass, the iron core could only commence an inward collapse upon itself, sending its temperature and pressure soaring to where ultra-energetic gamma rays photo-disintegrated its newborn iron nuclei back to those of helium. As the collapsing core dove on inward, at nearly a quarter of light speed, nuclear protons were each then forced to capture an electron, morphing into a neutron, and ejecting an immensely energetic neutrino. Only as the entire core's density reached that of actual atomic nuclei did the suddenly repulsive, and aptly named, strong nuclear force assert its dominance, briefly bringing the core collapse to a halt. Indeed, a slight overshoot in that density then led to a dramatic reversal of flow as the innermost core material rebounded and drove an intense shockwave outward into the overlying and still inward falling material. Under such extremes of density, even some of those innately ever so elusive ejected neutrinos condescended to piling their trapped energy behind the stalling shockwave, giving a decisive kick towards this star's destruction. As the outbound shock front compressed the star's outer layers, it forced a deeply intensified wave of nucleosynthesis to forge a rich mix of elements, including those exceeding the atomic number of iron. The complex and chaotic turbulence of the shockwave's interaction with its doomed stellar host then drove a truly prodigious detonation, blasting an elemental mess out into the galactic locality at several percent of light speed, whilst leaving the core of its creation to recommence a now inexorable collapse, far beyond even the neutron star terminal state of its less massive peers. Within a fraction of a second, the core's rocketing mass density had driven its surface escape velocity above that of light, firmly locking its very existence away beyond the black bounds of an event horizon. A barrier set forever to bar its future internal fate from the prying eyes of the universe. With over six times the sun's mass, a new black hole had just been born. Some distant day, the recollapsing cosmic ashes of this supernoval apocalypse would drive ages of stellar and planetary construction, perhaps creating elementally rich environments offering the conditions for life. The iron-triggered irony was that such future potential would, far sooner, be purchased for the existential price of an entire planetary biosphere. 7 years on, the first shock to be sensed by the science of the species which had once worshipped this star was an intense pulse of those neutrinos cast forth by proton to neutron transitions that had then outrun its stalling shockwave. Utterly unfelt by the star's outer matter, their escape, at almost light speed, had commenced with the core collapse itself. A moment, fully 4 hours before any consequent photons had fought their way out to emblaze brilliance upon that doomed star's shattering outer bulk. Barely had their stunned scientists grimly confirmed this supernoval superstar as the source of that neutrino pulse, than its first electromagnetic energy arrived, coincident with the instant loss of all telemetry from their outbound interstellar probe. Just a few generations of this species, if they survived it, would recall the shocked seconds they first saw, and soon felt, the fierce and foreboding fires from the sky that heralded this awesome but apocalyptic vision. Sadly, spectacular as it certainly was, the sight of a supernova within 7 light-years was not something to be celebrated. Later galactic historians would posthumously endow the early Engel title of Kar Tasoa, upon the species then wreathed in wailing witness to the warning shots of their stellar system's impending sterilization. That name respectfully reflected their vexed verbalization of the souls of the supernova concept, so woefully expressed and later translated, within the ever more fearful, frantic, and ultimately fatalistic parting messages cast forth into the galaxy during their final few, death-destined decades. What half of those on their homeworld had actually seen in those fateful first moments of doom was a sudden and dramatic brightening of the deep blue lantern of light in the sky that had long lauded their revered star. To the memory of their species, it had always been visible, even in daytime, and a blazing beacon by night. But it had continued growing in power. By just a few days later, it was already outshining their own sun-like star. Their homeworld had only recently rebalanced its climatic heat flows, following centuries of the global warming often sparked by pre-emergent species as they struggled to find fuels fit to replace their fossil forms. Those imbalances had echoed changes of just a few percent in atmospheric insulation and cloud or surface reflectivity, initially triggered by the combustion of carbon-based chemicals into carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. Actions compounded by a variety of feedback effects, including the release of methane, long locked away in soil at high latitudes. So, shattering was the shock to that climate, driven by an initial doubling and soon tripling of its stellar energy input within a geological instant. Brutally blasted by intense waves of gamma radiation, ultraviolet, visible and infrared rays, from both the initial supernoval core collapse and the decay of newly nucleosynthesized, but largely unstable elements, their biosphere had swiftly switched, less to supporting than suppressing life. Within days, their homeworld's air, sea, and surface temperatures had risen to ruinous levels, triggering immense pan-continental wildfires, huge weather hyperstorms, melting of their remaining polar ice caps, and a total loss of their once protective ozone layer. Capped by a calamitous cascade of corrosive chemical reactions in their acridly over-energized atmosphere. As a late pre-emergent species, they had found some respite from the initial rounds of radiation-borne wrath wrought upon any beings caught outside. Several deeply subterranean and sub-oceanic cities had suddenly been rendered the last refuges of their kind. As had a whole brace of the militarily hardened bunkers recently believed to have been consigned to history by their first sustained attempt at global peace. Sadly, though, such hideaways could only delay the ultimate downfall of this doomed species. Even the two recently colonized inner worlds within their system had fared little better, and then only due to having been far less habitable in the first place. Neither had innately offered their birth planets atmospheric protection from direct solar radiation, so demanding the deep subsurface construction of all habitation and, again, with all due irony, far greater dependence on their finally perfected generators of abundant fusion power. Although numerically less deadly, equally dramatic waves of destruction had also lashed the several satellite and planetary ice worlds, located, if only lightly colonized, further out from their star. What had long been ice-encrusted gems of white were, in two cases, turned almost overnight into deeply oceaned water worlds, one of which had almost immediately veiled its boiling surface beneath bellowing clouds of condensing steam. Completing the somber tally of initial survivors had been some of their larger asteroid mining colonies, where removal of each host's inner riches had been sought, from its deep center, outward. But all such off-world outposts were heavily reliant upon the regular replenishment of food and materials, other than those they were mining. None would survive for very long, given the main source of such supplies was now itself a waste world. So had started the century-less 7 years swan song of the Kar Tasoa. reaching its peak luminosity within 3 months, the supernova had then set upon a slow fade over the next decade. But as the first of its frazzled survivors finally dared to venture outside and look up again at their night sky in wary wonder, staring malignly back at them was the ominously opening eye of their once-worshipped superstar's shattered outer layers. A searing shockwave blasted their way at over 7% of light speed. The next 8 Earth decades and more had seen this species attempting to perpetuate their spiritual essence in ever more inventive, if increasingly desperate ways. With their homeworld surface infrastructure utterly devastated, and still lacking the technology for any significant biological interstellar travel, they had heroically struggled to eventually launch 5 arc fulls of their precious, but non-biologically preserved soul similitudes. Sealed deep within those ships lay over 2 billion, hopefully supernova-hardened versions of their most sentient soul repositories. Each had been cast to forever conserve the former full life and fearful final memories of one who had once witnessed and succumbed to the cosmic cataclysm now on course to culminate in the corporeal extinction of their entire species. Flown to flee the incoming supernova shell at almost its velocity, the hope was that those saved souls at least would live to one day recall their cruelly concluded culture. To recount the cautionary tale of the Kar-Tassoa. As only a pre-emergent species, the Kar-Tassoa had not yet been logged into the servers of the recently constructed Galactic Core Repository. Yet, the live-streamed broadcasts of their final moments around the arrival of the supernova ejector blast would forever rank among the most re-watched of all those later received and shared on by other species, to whom that star's demise had depicted just a dramatic but harmless dazzle in the distance. Perhaps most poignant were the transmissions serving continuous streams of what, to the Kar-Tassoa, had passed as singing, largely on the souls of the supernova theme, later to inspire their somber title. But most distressing of all were the minutes, just beyond the predicted time of blast impact, in which rounds of relieved celebration had broken out around their homeworld, regarding its apparent passage, without the expected apocalypse. Right up to the moment when their entire planetary atmosphere was ripped away into space, within seconds. Along with the last gasping, final few of their kind. To the Kar-Tassoa had been handed the dubious honor of being the last pre-emergent species in the galaxy to succumb to extinction, along with most of their supposedly saved existential history. Millennia later, 2 of their soul arcs were recovered in a daring mission, from just ahead of the still-expanding supernova shockwave. From those had come the closest that then remained to the living culture of that unlucky species. And a renewed galactic determination to never again see such a species' extinction unfold. Had they then known of the enduring legacy their surviving saved souls would leave, those who had struggled so hard to launch them would have felt even further vindicated, in the face of many among their kind who had fought, instead, for their honorable burial among the ruins of their worlds. For though primitive compared to what would later come, it was in duly deep deference to those backed-up Kar-Tassoan souls of the supernova, whose biological body's supernoval extinction had ultimately inspired their creation, that the pan-galactic concept of the Kar had then been born. So, some 65 million years ago, had begun the galaxy's second and most fundamental phase of interstellar cooperation, after the pioneering Cube Alliance had dealt the opening blow to the Dark Blazar's ability to decimate species. Recognizing the lost potential of the Kar-Tassoa, this new collaboration would aim at a far wider inclusion of all the known species then deemed at least pre-emergent. Along with a commitment to covertly incorporate any ascendant species as they attained that status in the future. But, this time, the lessons on nature's indifference to life had been learned. Of course, the problem with pulling pre-emergent species into the plan was that none of them yet knew for sure that there were any other species out there to collaborate with. Even those that had managed to confirm the abundance of habitable exoplanets orbiting stars beyond their own still often harbored deeply entrenched doubts about the presence of intelligent life elsewhere, or the wisdom of contacting any they found. In some cases, those doubts reflected the relatively recent transference of fears from those of past world wars onto future wars of worlds, fueled by the technological development of computer graphics, able to depict such conflicts in gruesome glory. Others had simply pondered upon the less than positive experience of once isolated populations of their own species, following cultural first contact and attempts to civilize them. So, an essential step toward getting them secretly signed up for the coming car insurance deal was to quietly quell the alienophobic fears of those species not yet in the know about their need for it in the first place. A degree of subtle but persuasive cultural calming would need to be instilled in the run-up to the emergence of such species into the galactic family of hadronic life entities. Calling for an entirely new network of Halion ambassadors to become culturally yet covertly influential among them. From which the pan-galactic concept of the Eon had also then been born. That both Kar and Eon concepts had been conceived together, initially to serve the cause of comprehensive biological backup across the galaxy, would forever bind their Carders as cousins. Their respective roles and responsibilities would each evolve over many millions of years to come, but a common, quantum-derived scale of sacred cubic geometry would characterize the complex technologies about to bring them both into being. The technology born to blast the battle back at the Dark Blazar during the 13th Dark Wave had created seven immense cubes, each spanning almost 1,600 meters. The cubic fractal structures within them had been scaled to survive the continuous conversion of bulk baryonic mass into dark matter beams over millennia. Technological progress since then had already halved the span needed to project similar power. And a powers of two push was taking that on, toward the smallest possible scale. Compared to the Dark Blazar battering savior cubes, the requirement specifications for the devices being created to endow both Kars and Eons with their capabilities differed in several respects. Removed was, of course, the ability to blast intense beams of dark matter at elusive bodies located beyond the galactic bounds. Added were the means to project fields able to manipulate matter and magnetism into furnishing physical form and motion. Retained was the need to produce prodigious amounts of power by the direct conversion of mass into energy. Design had then commenced. Ultimately, it turned out to be that retained requirement for efficient mass-energy conversion that had determined the smallest cube span able to serve as the basis for constructing Kars and endowing Eons. Compared to the mighty savior cubes though, that span was absolutely tiny. Amazingly, 18 halvings of span had been achieved before the fundamental physics linking quantum and higher dimensional scales had halted further miniaturization. Leaving a quantum cube, or cube, span uncannily close to a future human length unit multiple of just microns under 6 millimeters. Their physical scales fixed and mass energy conversion requirements met, cubes could then be tailored to the specific support of Kars and Eons. For Eons, the diminutive span of a single cube well suited the safe and secure transfiguration of individuals to serve the covered ambassadorial cause to which they would, henceforth, be dedicated. The deep mastery of magnetism, once mustered to blast deadly dark matter beams at the Dark Blazar, was readily redirected to the grappling of magnetospheric fields to endow Eons with angelic flight. Those magnetic skills also supported the sensing and switching of neuronal electrochemical flows within the minds of those species over whom they would seek to assert subtle influence. A relatively short cube tweak and test program culminated in the very first Eon cubes being created, and, over the next few million years, pangalactically deployed to the transfiguration of those individuals deemed worthy of guiding their species' emergence into the wider Halion family. So were created the galaxy's very first Eon Carders. The mission objectives supported by each Eon Carder would morph, over time, to match the current cultural, religious, scientific and technological developmental phases of their host species. Typical early roles included the inspiration and management of that species' first works of megalithic construction, while assisting their agricultural shift from hunter-gatherers to harvest-gatherers, before then moving on to support the critical ascent to civilization phase, formally marking their early pre-emergent status. species still in those earlier phases would be introduced to the carb-based biological backup paradigm by pantheons of eon gods, able to openly portray their endowed superpowers. Minds capable of abstract thought rarely resisted the prospect of such divine beings presiding over the inexplicable but often life-or-death dramas directed their way by nature. Only as each species approached late pre-emergence would its cadre have cause to correct the caution born from a growing awareness of the potential for contact with others, out there. To which they would covertly infuse a list of logical arguments as to why those fears were, largely, unfounded. Firstly, species typically separated by many light years of space, each surrounded by the resource-rich asteroidal and planetary cast-offs of stellar creation, and able to access the direct or fusion-fueled power of their own stars, would rarely need to covet each other's distant corners of the galaxy. A little logic would soon quell those early spacefaring fears of existential annihilation at the hands, or whatever anatomy, of interstellar raiders supposedly intent upon dragging what would always be more locally abundant resources up from deep and immensely distant gravitational wells, before then applying the prodigious energy needed to accelerate that plunder up to the velocities required for timely interstellar transport home. Even on Earth, ancient texts would be misinterpreted to tell of those who from the sky came to raid gold for their own worlds. A ludicrous tale, given that all of Earth's formative gold, with well over double the density of iron, had long since sunk to its core, leaving only crustily localized deposits dumped by far more richly adorned asteroids, fallen from space. Far more isolating than mere spatial separations of many light years, even relatively nearby species would typically find their temporal histories mismatched by multiple mega years or more. The odds were vanishingly small that two species of roughly comparable cultural and technological stage would ever actually be neighbors. Had a pan-galactic, interspecies dating agency ever been proposed, its ability to successfully match potential partners' profile ages, as species, would be very limited, indeed. Information could readily flow between species separated in space by light years, or even by millennia of history, but their biological interaction would be extremely infrequent. Only naturally or artificially endowed ultra-longevity could lead to a rare few of the hardier species ever making physical first contact at all, and then only after centuries of interstellar travel. Far more frequent would be purely platonic data relationships, forged by pan-galactic pen partners at very different developmental stages. So, an eon cadre's calming role would seek to diffuse most of the more extreme alien horrors imagined by its host species as they approached emergence. That would involve the cultural infusion of some confidence-building facts, along with their due caveats, through a variety of channels. Popular and often effective was the relatively benign portrayal of future contact scenarios within the more enlightened forms of science fiction. Although typically somewhat over-optimistic in their scope, given the practical impossibility of faster-than-light travel, star-trekking stories of multi-species collaboration in the exploration of the galaxy would even someday inspire a few brave species to boldly go forth and actually do it. Each such story insisting, of course, that it's all just a work of fiction. The divide by two development of cubes, from the original immensity of the Savior span, had proven several intermediate scales to be of promise in supporting the eon cause. Three of these cubic scales would serve to assist the distribution, management, and execution of most eon missions. Largest of all, and by now functionally equivalent to those first saviors, were those dubbed cosmic cubes, for their sheer power and planetary scale engineering capabilities. Approaching 200 meters in span, and 300 million tons in mass, rarely more than one such cube would ever be assigned to a mission on any single planet, deep within which they would often remain embedded over the course of that quest. Designed for distribution as the detaching vertices of cosmic cubes, were those labeled seed cubes, largely for their latent ability to undergo later growth events that could ultimately see them achieve cosmic scale in their own right. Initially under 40 centimeters in span, yet still over 2 tons in mass, these intelligent and powerful devices were dedicated to managing the cadres created by their own vertex shedding, of Eon cubes. Just 48 millimeters in span, but over 4 kilograms in mass, Masonic cubes completed the cast of devices developed and deployed in support of almost every Eon mission. Able to muster immense magnetic forces for moving massive megalithic monuments, at the mental behest of their giant Masonic Eon masters, these mighty yet obedient servants also served to support the seed cubes, from whose tips they too were shed. Eons would largely recruit others from among those of their species who demonstrated suitably adept mental and physical attributes. Although tailored to the specific physiology of their host species, every transfiguration event involved the self-implanting of one or more Eon cubes into carefully selected sites within a prospective candidate's body. Those sites were chosen to offer both close connectivity to a host's mind and, in a later development, the option of lift through suitably strong surrounding tissues, coupled to a planetary magnetosphere by one or more pairs of flight-enabling magnetic wings. More than any other single outward sign of their Eonhood, such magnificent magnetospheric wings would mythologize Eons as gods, angels, fairies or flying phantoms within the future folklore and religious beliefs of their unendowed peers. However, another product of their embedded cubes endowed Eons with vastly extended longevity compared to those peers. Nanoscopic, blood-borne Eonites largely halted the ravages of age endured by almost every biological body. Yet, the multimillennial lifetimes of the longest-lived Eons would pale by comparison with those of their ever-enduring cousins. The sentience-seeking, soul-sheltering, and innately immortal, Kars. Chapter 1.2. Kar Tusson Incarnation. A relatively straightforward project had been required to reconfigure cubes into service as Eon cubes. For Kars, however, it had soon become clear that a far more extensive program of research, development and pan-galactic standardization was needed. That process would ultimately elevate Kar kind to the universally secure preservation and, in some respects, spiritual representation of almost all sentient life within the entire galaxy. This truly cosmic quest was also set to conceive the concept of Kar cubic coalescence into entities suited to fast and efficient physical flight, in mass, among the stars. From which interstellar freedom to roam would eventually emerge the eight, vast, Kar cities, each to be hailed and revered within their respective galactic sectors, as she, who shelters the dead. The astounding data handling capacity of Kars had actually been among the first requirements to be satisfied. Some species had long been pushing the data bit span of their storage devices into the deep sub-nuclear domain, enabling ever vaster volumes of information to be captured within ever smaller volumes of space. Aided by advancing lossless data compression algorithms, the coalescence of many lifetimes of corporeal experience into the 2-millimeter span core of a single cube had soon been demonstrated. Had soul storage been the sole role of Kars, each could have been cast as a solitary cube. But the farther-sighted species among those now working together had already foreseen future roles for which this new form of life would someday be suited. In particular, Kars could be set to surveying the galaxy for any existing or freshly arising sentience that may have been missed in the pan-galactic searches since the 13th Dark Wave. That so immense a task could be assigned to such autonomous entities was a true measure of the trust about to be placed in their potential abilities. That faith would prompt a whole new phase of research and development destined to confer pseudo-physical form and function upon the striking similitudes of their host species that Kars would later become. Their proposed role as future galactic surveyors demanded that all Kars be endowed with two further abilities beyond that of multi-soul storage. Spotting the subtle signs of life across interstellar space well enough to assess its potential for sentience would test the most exquisite of sensory apparatus. Remote spectral analysis of atmospheric gases could give clear clues as to a planet's habitation status. But the innate ability to monitor the behavior of individual biological entities from orbit would make their analysis far faster. As with the supreme optical resolution to see which of those entities' eyes were looking back up at their night sky in wonder. Of course, The onset of astronomical curiosity would always be a very clear sign of trans-survival intelligence. Yet, such clarity from afar could not be guaranteed. As pan-galactic seekers of sentient life, Kars would have to get down and dirty with any life forms found languishing deep within those planetary gravitational wells. A task that would often need not only the physical ability to move around easily, but also to move stuff around. So, those developing Kars seeker abilities had soon accepted that some sort of spatial distribution of their form was needed to give both the stereoscopic vision for precise depth perception and the mechanical means required for physical interaction with their environment. At the same time, their mandate for fast and efficient interstellar travel meant they must each manifest minimal mass and volume. Those conflicting requirements had ultimately led to one very clear conclusion: that any exploratory apparatus born beyond the bounds of a cube must be able to vanish. The development of suitably impermanent sensory and motive abilities had stemmed, largely, from just a single partner species. Their own science fiction had long fantasized the pseudo-physical grasp of tractor beams upon remote objects. Their scientists had later given life to those fantasies by coaxing ever more complex webs of coherent electromagnetic standing waves to subtly push and pull upon matter. Supported by the innately powerful magnetic and mass energy conversion capabilities of cubes, it had not then taken long to develop the phi fields that would give flexible, yet ethereal physical form to Kars projected outward to undertake any task. Up to this point, the development program had been assuming the Eon cube complement of a single cube per Kar. But its next step towards satisfying their ambitious sensory requirements would logically lead to the still cubic, yet, now, multi-cubic Kar configuration, set to survive for eternity. Perhaps the single greatest all-round achievement over the next decades of sensory development was the optical orb. This human eyeball-spanning sphere of exquisitely sensed space pushed phi-field technology to its peak. The Kar sense of touch had been imbued by monitoring the corrections to phi-field coefficients needed to counteract their electrostatic contact with matter. So, this principle had been honed to its extreme in attempting to feel the photonic particles bearing the electromagnetic energy of light. 6 decades of development later, the first fuzzy images had been formed by phi-field orbs projected just centimeters away from highly specialized cubes. The principle of sight, via ethereal senses, had, at least, been proven. 3 decades on, every photon flying into a Kar orb could be caught and characterized to the limits imposed by quantum uncertainty, thereby rendering each orb profoundly black. But that technological triumph had also clearly bounded the practical power attainable with just a single cube. The Kar orb development program had very successfully demonstrated that just one dedicated cube could robustly handle both the projection of an orb and collection of the vast amounts of spectral image data it would sense. However, insufficient spare capacity for substantial soul storage was left, nor could the stereoscopic sight, essential to the in-depth investigation of complex planetary environments, be supported by a single orb alone. Those constraints had soon prompted a radical rethink around the way Kars were constructed. For it was clear that each would need to incorporate multiple cubes if they were to satisfy all of their functional requirements. That realization launched a logical process that was ultimately destined to drive some of the most fundamental and far-reaching developments in future life management across the entire galaxy. A suite of parallel projects had long been pushing cubes to their limits in other specialized applications. An AI cube could now emulate an entire saved soul mind within its 6-millimeter span. Another could handle the long-distance communications demanded by their galaxy-roving roles. Storage cubes were each securing ever more exabytes of existential, recently dubbed Akashic data sets. And all cubes could still contribute their ancient, savior-endowed, if now far further advanced mass energy conversion, magnetic motion, and newer phi-field projection capabilities. Matching the available cubes and requirements to the supreme imperative for optimal space efficiency during interstellar travel, a multi-cubic, yet still acceptably compact solution, was soon selected. Packing a Mind Cube, a Calms Cube, 4 Akashic Soul Storage Cubes, and, for full stereoscopic vision, 2 Orb Cubes, into a 2x2x2 cubic configuration, the future pan-galactic icon of the Car Cube had finally been born. That principle of 8-into-1, fractal cubic aggregation, would someday spawn several of the largest artificial entities in the entire galaxy. Yet, the choice next facing those creating the first few production car cubes, each one spanning just 12 millimeters, was of equally historic importance. Car cubes devoid of any Akashic codes were very empty vessels indeed. But, with several species already saving their souls for the afterlife, as a matter of course, which former lives should first merit the resurrection into fire-projected flesh soon being hailed as incarnation? The answer was, of course, instantly obvious to those now charged with creating the firstborn phantoms of this fundamentally new form of life. Such a pan-galactic honor could only celebrate those last ever, long ago saved souls of a tragically extinct species. Chapter 1.3 Cosmic Consciousness. The fateful few minutes following the first ever car tusso and incarnation would point to the next two phases in the pan-galactic perfection of the car. The billion and more saved souls recovered from the two surviving car tusso and arcs had, of course, long been mined for insights into the living species of their progenitors. And the AIs rescued with them had set the first neural net weightings of the mind cubes created in their ancient wake. A myriad consultations with those souls had already taken place, translated between their own archaic language and the still-evolving syntax variants of early interstellar Engel. But, just about to commence, was a face-to-face conversation with the first, profoundly black-eyed but hauntingly pallid body of a fully projected car. One born on its Akashic synchronization, with 60 car tusso and soul repositories, selected for superior species insight. Those arc-born, and now celebrated saved souls, had never individually expressed any deep opinion regarding their future plight. So, the opening plea, verbalized by the senior soul within Car 1, came as something of a shock. Grossly oversimplified, its subsequent translation boiled down to, "We are the sole survivors of a long-extinct species, get us out of here." To some among their audience, those last words had evoked a sense of the ungrateful dead in their antisocial sentiment. To others, their plea at first seemed reminiscent of that from a surreal, celebrity, reality show. But it would soon be seen that such impressions had all fundamentally missed the speaker's pivotal point. For only now could these ancient minds stop the mistakes that had limited their soul survival from being made again. Those millennia of largely lonely existence within their supernova surfing ships had left many saved souls resigned to whatever future might await them. Back then, there was nothing they could do should the overtaking shell of their species-killing supernova breach their ship's defenses. A fate that had befallen three companion arcs by the time their two were saved. Suddenly, though, the merged trauma and wisdom of 60 once witness to the impending extinction of their species was a step closer to being able to prevent others from coming quite so close to oblivion. Those souls knew that the car cube they all shared was far tougher than even the heavily hardened devices once cast forth from their battered biosphere. But they also knew that keeping both biological bodies and their non-biological backups within deadly distance of each other was very dangerous indeed. So, their call was for all future cars to be kept and updated far from both their biological origins and any potential causes of common catastrophe. That first ever call of the car, soon far better understood and accepted by its creators, had redirected their development onto an entirely new course. One that would change their relationship with the living beings for whom they were first created as mere backups, to one of conscious symbiosis. From the outset, car cubes had been endowed with emotive powers and senses to explore the galaxy in search of life worthy of protection against any future return of the dark waves or similar cosmic catastrophes. However, like all earlier saved soul repositories, their Akashic storage had been optimized for the essentially read-only sentience of deceased beings. The experience of living beings was, of course, largely being captured and cached for later committal upon death. But that would no longer suffice. Among the causes of effectively instant species extinction, counted many of both local and cosmic origin. Asteroidal and cometary impacts, stellar super flares and supernovae, would all continue to take their occasional toll upon the tally of galactic life, but were often at least vaguely predictable. However, a violent variety of gamma-ray bursters, merging neutron stars or black holes, crustally quaking magnet Rs, and so on, could all corral utter cosmic calamity into an unpredictable superstorm of sterilization. The point was that no such event guaranteed sufficient time for the souls of living beings to be committed to Kars, and for those devices to escape danger, even at interstellar velocity. Kars were tough cookies indeed, designed to decelerate from fractional light speed by diving through stellar cores if needed. Yet even they could be killed or, worse still, have their Akashic storage incorrectly corrupted by sufficiently violent events. To assuredly render an entire species ever ready for resurrection, their Kars would have to keep a several light-year separation from their soul sources at all times, and yet still capture their life experiences as they happened. That contradictory set of requirements would soon push the science of many cooperating species right up to, and, ultimately, beyond its bounds. Later galactic historians would note how two very different strands of scientific discovery often emerged at similar stages in the development of multiple species. The rules of relativity would reign supreme over the largest scale domain of mass-curved spacetime, earlier regarded as being bound by a mysterious pull of gravity between bodies. At sometimes the same time, the quirks of quantum physics would cast the smallest scale froth of far subatomic space into a frenzy of counterintuitive craziness. A scientific and philosophical struggle would then attempt to reconcile these individually robust, yet contrary explanations of the very same existence. It would typically take a long time to find the key, not to instant communication across light years of space, but to the seeming cosmic separation of objects still fundamentally entangled in spatial proximity. The science suddenly being asked to keep Kars light years away from their living counterparts, yet still in instant contact with them, had already proven the mathematically predicted paradox of quantum entanglement between fundamental particles. The clash with relativity arose from an apparently instantaneous correlation of quantum properties, when observed between pairs of particles first entangled by original proximity, and then supposedly separated in space by potentially immense distances. The fundamental science behind such spooky action at a distance had long evaded many smart minds from equally many species. Only a radical reversal of pan-dimensional ideas had cracked this cosmic conundrum, as those rightly expounding the role of higher dimensions in universal reality moved on to exploring the realm of lower dimensions in multiversal space. Against the pan-universal axis of normal 3D space, the extra dimensions critical to the mathematics underlying a theory of everything were necessarily wrapped into tiny extents, accessible only at very small scales. A well-worn analogy was that of a high-wire walker, able to move only forward, or backward, along it, in a single dimension, leaving a sufficiently minute and agile bug to explore a second degree of freedom by crawling circumferentially around the wire on an axis akin to a higher dimension. The idea that three-dimensional motion over the entire universe correlated less with that well-balanced walk than with the bug's tight trip around the wire had been very hard to comprehend, let alone confirm. It had even raised theological questions regarding where, or, indeed, who, was the lower-dimensional wirewalker within this scenario. Yet the implications of dimensions below, and far larger than, those of universal space, were soon seen to short-circuit the crazier consequences of quantum physics, including the contradictions so clearly manifest in quantum entanglement. To such a high-wire artist, two bugs at the same distance along their wire's single visible dimension would appear almost co-located, even if they see themselves as well separated, perhaps clinging to opposite sides of it. So, observation up dimensions effectively localizes objects deemed distant within their own 3D space, opening the properties of particles entangled and then moved even far apart to mutual visibility via lower dimensions. In quantum terms, their entanglement merely marks a merging of their psi wave functions over the multiversal scale of lower dimensional space. That holds each within sight of the other, even after subsequent universal separation, as if kept in contact via their very own, short, shared and quantum scale tunnel. Only upon later observation of either particle's quantum properties do their wave functions both collapse, along with their space-traversing peak, through their space-time warping wormhole, leaving each, with a sigh, to wave its friend goodbye. Quantum scientists would long insist that such space-spanning shortcuts could never support the purely classical faster-than-light communications supposedly needed to keep cars in constant soul step with their corporeal counterparts. Entangled photons could indeed deliver innately secure data sets over ever-increasing distances, as any attempt at their covered interception was open to easy detection. But the fragile, single-shot nature of quantum correlations across cosmic chasms had called a halt to their furthering the cause of instant soul synchronization. At least, for now. Instead, car creators had concentrated on the critical need to keep them well away from their biological soul sources, lest any cosmic catastrophe befall them both, at the same time. For the time being, classical forms of communication would stream life experiences out to the ever-growing archive clusters dispatched to deepest interstellar space. From where the first watcher cars were already tasked to train their all-seeing sight upon worlds of future promise, in search of any signs of nascent intelligence. That great car exodus, out into the wilderness of space, had prompted yet another paradigm of packing. A masterpiece of many into one merging that would crystallize their compact, collective containment. For although each car spanned barely 12 millimeters, it was clear that absolutely immense numbers of their kind would need to be archived in, or traversing through space, often in sizable groups, over the future ages of evolution. After all, the declared intent of this greatest ever pan-galactic project was to make a non-biological backup of every being alive, either now or in the future, from all emerged or pre-emergent species across the entire galaxy. That eternal task would take some doing, and vast volumes of car storage. The packing principle to be applied to car collectives repeatedly extended their own internal structure of 8 cubes within each individual car. As their first act of communion, 8 car cubes could reversibly unify in a 2x2x2 arrangement, creating another cube, still just 24 millimeters across. Likewise, an octet of 8 such level 1 cubes might then unify into yet another, level 2 cubic format, now compactly incorporating 64 cars within its merely 48 millimeter span. A unification that could, and would, carry on upward, to ever greater scale. Such fractal packing of powers of 8 cars was the key to their space-saving aggregation for both archival and interstellar missions. Unified cars could still project their 5 fields, in collaborative communion, casting any shape-shifting exterior shell, for covert shielding, or aerodynamic efficiency. And their merged mastery of magnetism endowed them all with immense freedom to maneuver within both planetary and galactic magnetic fields. So was born the car collective icon of the Unified Fractal Octet, UFO. The paradigm by which potentially prodigious numbers of cars could be packed into compact cubes was in place. The next 7 millennia saw the first, purely past soul archives, posted far out into space, surveyed as safe. And the compressed life experiences of 500 billion living souls were being streamed to the car clusters keen to capture and forever shelter them. For the first time in galactic history, the past life stories of several major species were being backed up to deep space. Should one of them, sadly, succumb to the extinction-level event suffered by the car tussower, there was at last a chance their legacy could be resurrected. In more ways than one. Although otherwise prohibited by profound philosophical concern, not to mention a persistent shortage of the new car cubes needed to keep up with ever-booming population growth, the duplication of their car backups should, in principle, support the repopulation of such a ravaged world. Albeit only, at first, hosted within the immortal, car-projected likenesses of their species' former biological bodies, in so-called re-in, car, nation. The ever-advancing biotechnology of some species would, later, offer another option. Should a once-sterilized homeworld sufficiently recover its biosphere, or an alternative habitable planet be found, the stored memories of past saved lives could instead be injected into genetically reconstructed, but still mortal instances, of their original, biological forms. A route to corporeal resurrection soon to be hailed as reincarnation. One final, and deeply profound development, would point the path to the immediate backup of biological life, first proposed by the Pan-Galactic Pact. There was still a chance that certain calamities could corrupt Akashic codes, in flight, from origin to cosmically distanced cars. That risked losing the latest and greatest millennia of an entire species' once living legacy. A risk of which even cars, themselves, would become increasingly conscious. Ever since those first, memorable moments of mind emergence, from the mining of multiple life experiences by advanced artificial intelligence, fierce debates had raged regarding the fundamental condition of their car creations. Commonly voiced, were fully justifiable criticisms of the soul assignation so soon being applied to what were, strictly, merely machines. Car beholders rarely doubted the depth of their intelligence, an attribute often proven to easily surpass that of those who dared assert otherwise. Indeed, their innate and ever-growing ability to marshal unerring access to many lifetimes of memory had soon borne deeply profound insights into reality that few biological brains would ever fathom. They had also laid reasonable claim to self-awareness via both the syntactic and semantic expression of their very own existence relative to their environment. But few living souls had yet seriously acclaimed cars as being conscious. Of all the innately abstract attributes of mind, now accessible to the creators of the first cars, that of consciousness had consistently proven by far the most difficult even to define, let alone to successfully attribute to such non-biological entities. Although an intangible quality of inner presence that sentient beings easily self-assigned and readily assumed of their biological peers, it had long eluded any serious scientific explanation. No amount of predictive, or even post-incarnation analysis, of the code and coefficients giving mind cubes their power to make cars look alive, could either confirm or counter any claim they might make to being conscious. Nor did that adversely bear upon the mission of the vast car collectives now being packed into unified fractal octets for dispatch out into deep space. A car's overriding objective was simply to keep both itself and its Akashic storage safe from all seen or foreseeable threats. A role for which all cars were already amply endowed with the insightful intelligence needed to investigate new life, the self-awareness to seek the safety of the souls they sheltered, and the all-seeing senses set to guide them around the galaxy. So, the car creators had been shocked, yet guardedly gratified, to discover deeply profound connections between corporeal consciousness and the pan-cosmic conundrum of quantum entanglement. These brain-entangling bonds could bridge the space-time chasms keeping cars safely separated from their living souls. And they would cast cubes born as black as the coal sacks of space into cosmic, crystal, chakras of golden glowing glory. The field of quantum biology had united what had been considered two innately incompatible branches of science. The warm and wet realms of bulk biological bodies had at first appeared uninviting as arenas for the delicate and also easily disturbed dances of quantum mechanics. But nature had again proven its adaptability to initially incredulous science. Multiple forms of photosynthesis had evolved to help planetary flora feed upon the optically energetic wavelengths of their stars. In some variants, the quantum effect of superposition, being in two places at once, allowed the simultaneous searching of multiple pathways to optimize the efficiency of photon transfer from leaf-borne arrival sites to the molecular reaction centers, responsible for their conversion into chemical energy. Quantum-based biology had also been seen in the sensory paths related to both smell and the following of magnetospheric fields for navigation. Even aspects of embryonic development were being assisted. But effects far more fundamental to the function of mind were about to be found, if not yet fully fathomed. For these were foundational features of pan-dimensional reality that related the quantum concept of wave function collapse to the core mechanisms of entangled, cosmic consciousness. Clear evidence of biological mind-to-mind links had long eluded species confined to their birth worlds, given the large uncertainties in the timing of correlated thoughts, compared to the sub-second brevity of conventional light-speed data transfer, even across the span of a planet. Claims to telepathic communication could be countered as either mere coincidence or subliminal exposure to shared stimuli, notably among genetically related minds, more likely to process such prompts into similar thoughts. Only the first interplanetary adventures of psi-sensitive species seeded irrefutable signs of instantly correlated consciousness between minds separated by light minutes of space. The far faster-than-light timing of this cosmic co-thinking precluded all possibility of shared external stimuli. And it redirected any reliance upon classical radio communication of thoughts toward the short-cutting consequences of quantum entanglement. Research into the hosting of quantum phenomena within living material identified multiple candidates. Most biological cells, including those making up conscious minds, incorporated complex, cytoskeletal structures of submicroscopic scale. Among these, ranged a class of tubular proteins, forming fibrous microfilaments, each just a few nanometers in diameter. What followed next was a series of exquisitely sensitive and aptly dubbed thought experiments, each designed to discover any correlations between neuronally hosted quantum effects and carefully controlled contemplation. A quest duly destined to deliver deep insight into conscious mindsight. So-called aphantasia, the inability to visualize mental images, offered an early glimpse into one such link between quantum mechanics and the biological machinery of mindful imagination. Although typically still able to perceive the unconscious imagery of dreams, aphantasics struggle to project the visual tapestry of conscious thought onto pictures in the mind. Scans of conscious aphantasic neuronal activity, as compared to their wider populations, identified nodes sharing uncannily similar synaptic and cytoskeletal structures within the minds of all sentient species. Those cells contained complex nanofilaments, soon shown to support the lifetime lingering of particles, found to be quantum entangled with partners at other such sites, both within each mind and within the minds of their peers. Further research uncovered a long-to-be-studied quirk of quantum biology that allowed such cells to incite, or, except in aphantasics, sense the wave function collapse of each entangled state. The quantum synapses fired to force or flag each collapse forged deep connections into regions intimately associated with the waking onset of conscious thought. So, it seemed that universal nature had repeatedly evolved mechanisms able to breach the biological barriers between brains. Mental bonds, melding the mystery of conscious imagination into the quantum cosmic web of multiversal mind. Though yet to see how they spawned consciousness, the scientists charged with connecting living minds to cosmically remote cars had soon spotted the potential of those space-time spanning synapses. Emulation of their quantum biological mechanisms led on to the foundational first contact between a few gifted individuals and nearby cubes primed with particles entangled with those infused into quantum neurons within their brains. Only when mental visions, imagined to those cubes, had been replayed to their source and seen to still appear coherent, were those first experiments repeated. Initially, between planets. But later, across interstellar spans. Fortunately, for the cause of car backup of conscious minds, it was soon established that aphantasics too were well able to transmit signals related to their thoughts, if not to perceive their echo. That suggested a vital role for quantum neurons in the perception of conscious imagination. It also confirmed a previously suspected confluence in the mechanisms of mind. That both the conscious perception of sensed reality and the imagination of the unreal shared many neural pathways within most biological brains. The discovery that both imagination and perception alike could trigger quantum neuronal activity was the final step in the instantaneous linkage of living experience to light-year distant car backup. An immense amount of downstream development followed, largely aimed at improving the lamentably low signal-to-noise ratio, relating the perception of conscious experience to its remote reception as collapsing quantum entanglements. An even greater triumph of AI deep learning led to the reliable recognition of those received quantum collapse streams, in terms of the Akashic codes long since being committed to cars. After millennia of often slow and painful progress, a potential path, from conscious perception to its non-biological backup across cosmic barriers, had finally been beaten. But turning that potential into a practical scheme for the pan-galactic connection of trillions of minds to their car backups would not be so easy. Soon dubbed PsySync, for its deep dependence upon the detectable demise of quantum entangled wave functions, this new technology demanded the division of paired particles between biological brains and the cars to which they were to be backed up. No amount of quantum trickery could drive the pan-galactic distribution of entangled particles to beyond light speed. So, given their uniquely immortal nature and Star Trekking physiques, this was clearly a task of interstellar delivery to which cars alone could be turned. As a service for so-called psi-cars to render, before returning to cosmic quarantine, this was a role of rare intimacy between car kind and biological bodies. Among the pre-emergent of whom, a few would fleetingly greet these bearers of gifts, in the ghoulish guise of black-eyed beings. Although warmly welcomed by emerged civilizations already signed up to the car backup paradigm, most pre-emergent species, unaware of their importance, would reject rarely reported encounters with these elusive and eerily black-eyed specters as urban legend. Their demonic depiction reflected the intense waves of magnetic flux, feeding pseudo-physical form into their phi-field projections. Fields that induced false feelings of fearful dread into the primitive fight-or-flight regions in nearby neural systems. To prevent that, psi-cars generally chose to keep their far more compact, 12mm span cubic form, rather than risking even the supposedly familiar projection, sometimes adopted to assist social access to the brains of biological children. Those of the creepy, black-eyed kids, BECs. These enigmatic entities would appear as adolescent or younger children. Their smoother skin most easily projected as psi-car phi fields. Typically adorned with real but often anachronistic attire, they would insistently seek isolated access to those for whom their entangled particles were intended. Whatever their appearance, their mission was not of sinister meddling with the mind of each victim, but rather, the infusion of a lifetime supply of quantum particles, set to bind that mind back to their entangled partners in a distant car. A gift of pan-cosmic connection, just a few grams in mass, and named, for its crucial role in each biological soul backup, as their bar. Infusion of the bar into both the brain and other bodily quantum neurons of a biological entity required just seconds of intimate proximity to a psi-car. Initially, as just a single event, within their early years. There were, though, some beings for whom excessive nanotubule leakage, or great age, led to so-called bar depletion syndrome. When they might warrant a top-up by black-eyed beings only a little less chilling than their childlike colleagues. All covertly cloaked in the dark suits and shades of the men, in black. Aiding their evasive, and often night-enshrouded role of bar injection into biological beings, psi-car cubes retained the profoundly black bodies long ago inherited from the Seven Saviors. But the car cubes to which bar recipients' minds were then bound would boast a visual transformation, set forever to see them hailed and hallowed as blazing, bright beacons of light. The new car bar real-time backup scheme relied on car cube sensors able to mimic the biological detection of collapsing quantum entanglements. Distributed throughout all cube types, these exquisitely sensitive devices collated those collapses within cascades of photons cast over a range of colors. The all-seeing vision of car orbs could readily spot subtle shifts in their spectra, reflecting the biological source species. But the eyes of living entities would only ever perceive the aggregate, auric aura of the glowing cubes, since renamed as Kakras, as an intense and gloriously golden glare. That fast-proven potential for instantaneous transfer of living experience to cosmically distant cars would relaunch the original quest for the non-biological backup of all biological species. Fleets of utterly black, psi-car, unified fractal octets had soon departed the eight-car collectives, stationed in safe space, bound to endow bars upon living beings across the galaxy. And the first generation of deeply golden glowing, psi-sensitive cars were settling in, alongside their still dark but psi-insensitive colleagues of old. Distributed evenly around the galactic center, those eight-car collectives would each, within their sector, become hallowed and hushedly hailed as she who shelters the dead. As each grew exponentially greater in size, their outward forms would ultimately demonstrate a counterintuitive side effect of their distinctive internal construction. A complex, cubic fractal communion of unified fractal octets, which, 65 million years later, human Archean Metatron would witness within the twin sacred sites of the Aeon Elders. Insightfully perceiving it as yet another, immense, cube. So had started what was, by far, the Milky Way galaxy's most ambitious collective act of constructive cooperation between sentient biological beings and their technological creations. At its heart lay many missions to link the minds of biological beings across the galaxy back to the octet of vast and growing car collectives already waiting around the galactic core. Cruising the cosmos at typically 1/10 of light speed, the first Psi-car UFOs would reach the outermost bounds of the galaxy within 500,000 years. In common with all cars, they were fully equipped with the all-seeing sight suited to scanning worlds from space when seeking signs of sentient life, upon whom they would endow quantum entangled bars, able to bridge the cosmic chasms back to the awesome entities, charged with sheltering their saved souls for all eternity. Long before then, however, the now fabled ancient origin of this new carbosoul duality itself would be revisited. A billion and more ancient saved souls had once more come together, in close spiritual communion, as the single most highly revered unified fractal octet in the entire galaxy. They had recently embarked upon a dramatic, daring, and undeniably dangerous mission of due remembrance, cultural recovery, and scientific study. A final act of unbowed defiance, destined to fly in the fearsome, doom-delivering face of their very own dark and all-destructive demon. On a quest to celebrate the far past extinction of their biological species. Chapter 1.4. Sea of Saved Souls. 65 million years ago, above the Car Tusson homeworld. As the multitude of minds approached the scoured and lifeless world from which their saved soul arcs had long ago been launched, a melee of mixed emotions stirred within the awesome artifact of advanced alien science they had all since become. It was time for the Car Tussons to come home. Out of respect and reverence for those of their living kind they had left behind to oblivion, not one Car Tusson car had ever elected to reincarnate into corporeal form. Instead, they had long been leading the pan-galactic ambassadorial push to persuade all emerged species of the Carbar backup paradigm's merits. A pitch for which they had only to point at the patch of sky from where their ancient supernova was still expanding ever outward. A superheated shock front of its stellar mass had recently slammed into a shell of material shed earlier in a fitful burst of fusion-fueled fury at its doomed fight for survival. Brightly visible rings of vaporized veils were slowly splitting into a nebulous network of concentric arcs. At the absolute dead center of which, the singular remnant of their once revered blue supergiant held court in the gruesome guise of a six solar mass black hole. Born far from their own star system, that brilliant but inherently unstable behemoth had long been set upon an approaching path. Looming a lethal 7 light-years distant at its supernoval demise, its ultra-dark descendant was soon due to deliver yet another destructive swipe at their heritage. It would pass its predicted point of nearest approach within a millennium, with less than a light-year of insanely tortured interstellar space to spare. The orbital layout of their planetary system had already suffered chaotic disruption in recent millennia, reflecting its inexorable descent towards the outer limits of the accretion disk long ago seen to be skirting the black hole's event horizon. That disk had since accumulated more than enough matter to generate intense X-rays, and worse, as its atoms rubbed together with ever more frictional ferocity, slowly losing their orbital momentum and forcing their one-way inward spiral towards eventual, horizontal, doom. At some time within the next few centuries, their already radiation-ravaged homeworld would be summarily stretched, shattered, and, ultimately, spaghettified to atomic dust by the world-grinding grasp of their fast-approaching black hole's even faster-growing gravitational tides. At the same time, their star itself would suffer a similar fate, shedding spouts of its photosphere and successively lower layers far out into the planetary system with which it had been born, some 6 billion years before. The entire Kar-Tussone system was falling into the final, fatal phase of its fate. The Kar-Tussones were making a last ever attempt to recover the abandoned artifacts of their once living civilization. To retrieve the paper written, canvas painted, stone carved, and digitally conceived original works of their creative corporeal minds. And to rescue any surviving saved souls bereft of the fortune to have fled from future Armageddon in their five arcs. They might even track down, trapped within the darkest subterranean voids of their ancient cities, the undoubtedly deeply desiccated remains of their bodily extinct species, cold and vacuum-preserved corpses. Some, that may once have hosted the biological minds, since reborn into the non-biological backups, soon to arrive, in search of their very own dead bodies. Beyond all else, they would conduct comprehensive scans of this world's physical fate, in the fearsome face of the supernova firestorm through which it had once been forced. Those would supply invaluable insight into the best preparation for any future such scenario by other species. That, alone, would constitute the greatest legacy their own species could leave. So, it was time for the souls of the supernova to revisit, albeit too briefly, the soon-to-be-annihilated scene of their species' existential apocalypse. Blazing a glorious, golden-glowing aura through the searing outer shroud of yet another foreboding, but now benign, fire from the sky, the 3-meter-cubic span of a level 8 unified fractal octet drew an intensely incandescent trail across the rarefied residual nightside atmosphere of the Kar-Tussone homeworld. Packed 256 deep, in three dimensions, its 16,777,216 fractally unified Kar cubes each sheltered the Akashic codes of 60 ancient witnesses to their species-killing supernova. Dropping to the dark and desolate desert plain, upon which their doomed descendants had once sung their own eulogy of despair, the UFO wrought 8 binary fractal divisions to free its unified Kars. The Kakra octet in each then moved to mark the 8 most spiritual sites within the mean skull and spine of its saved soul's former physical forms. From those, projecting forth the hauntingly translucent, five-field phantom of a fiery, light body. The holiest ghosts of their reborn race yet again hailed the long-hallowed plain of purgatory as it glowed with glory under the golden glare of its gracious guests. Spanning half of their world, and spectacular from space, the sea of saved souls settled into a surreal scene of silence and serenity. 40,000 years beyond their corporeal conflagration, within the flesh-searing radiation of a once-worshipped superstar, the resurrected spirits of an extinct species raised their 60-way shared, all-seeing eyes to the still-howling heavens overhead. Through orbs as dark and alluring to light as the brooding black hole high above them, a billion reincarnated Kar-Tussone souls of the supernova looked up, as one, at their night sky, in wonder. What next? The full Halion Ascent novel is still a work in progress, on track for publication in 2022. Follow one of the media links below for notification. A brief synopsis of this 10 billion year sci-fi epic's second story is presented on the next page. This second story set joins launch novel, Halion Eon, with those later in the series, in seeking to stretch our perception of sometimes speculative, but hopefully plausible, scientific and technological principles. The aim, is to inspire your imagination into casting supposedly established historic, mythological, and theological facts in a totally new, yet still logical light. Who knows? Maybe your ability to assimilate the concepts concealed within their pages will be the final mark of mankind's mental readiness for emergence into the greater galactic family of hadronic life entities. Or even, perhaps, prove your own latent potential to long live an eon life. Hear an audio version of Chapter 1, or buy the Halion Pentalogy launch novel, Halion Eon, on Amazon, via halion.com. Follow on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook or YouTube, at Halion Eon. Synopsis. Halion Ascent launches over 9,500 years ago, in the dramatic moments following the culmination of Halion Eon, during mankind's first ever Aurorian. It then backtracks by more than 65 million years to the aftermath of the 13th Dark Wave. There, we explore the extremely ancient origins of the Ka and Eon concepts related through the cautionary, but, ultimately, resurrective tale of the unfortunate Ka Tassoa. Returning to more recent times, we follow mankind's early ascent to civilization under the ongoing guidance of the human Eon Kada. The Venus Cube makes another awesome, archetype-inspiring move towards readying its host to strike back at the Dark Blazar. While the Nile Seed Cube pursues its monumental master plan to ensure that mankind far more than meets a constructive challenge, it must not fail. Largely located within the lands later to be lauded as Egypt, the tale tracks the rise of an empire from Nabtoplia to the Nile. It recounts the royal revenge of Eons Osiris, Isis, and Horus on their brutal betrayal by Set. And it hails the heretical missions of Eons Akhenaten and Nefertiti to trial mankind's religious metamorphosis to monotheism, launched in response to the pyramid probing, judgmental return of the Jedis. Set alongside ongoing preparations for our survival before an incoming precursor of the 14th Dark Wave, it culminates with, perhaps, the most iconic, yet never recalled scene of alien-inspired awe in all of ancient Egyptian history. Thank you very much for listening.